1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 15 through actually verse 27. I wrote 26, but it should be verse 27. Restricting the use of our rights to enhance our ministry effectiveness. We learned in our last lesson that those who minister for the Lord have specific spiritual rights, including freedom from ceremonial restrictions under the law, freedom to be married while ministering for the Lord, and the right to receive financial remuneration from those to whom they minister. Yet there's a higher calling than exercising such rights, that of restricting the use of one's rights to enhance his effectiveness through exposing his integrity to others. And Paul explained this in the verses that we're going to have tonight. I'd like to read the verses and then we'll look at it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 15 through 27. But I have none of these things, neither have I written these things that it should be so done unto me. For it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glorying void. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is me if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. What is my reward then? Truly that when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. For though I be free from all men, yet I have made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be a partaker thereof with you. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain. And every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it for obtaining a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. So I box, not as one that beats the air, but I keep my body under and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. And by castaway, he means disqualified for service. He doesn't mean losing his salvation. Okay, having taught in verses 6 to 14 that he, along with all of God's messengers, had the right to receive financial remuneration for his service of ministering the gospel, Paul asserted in verse 15a that he had not exercised that right, nor was he writing in order to motivate people to donate money to him. Paul was very concerned that people not feel obliged to give unto him, and he had a purpose for that, and he's going to explain why. Paul added that he would rather die than have anyone deprive him of his reason for glorying and the reason for why he was not receiving financial remuneration for his ministry. To clarify, Paul established that he had no special reward for actually preaching the gospel itself. If he didn't preach the gospel, he was in disciplinary trouble with the Lord. He had no alternative but preaching. That was his job as an apostle, leading people to Christ, preaching the gospel, so he had to do that. If he willingly obeyed the Lord to preach the gospel, he had a reward that was for that willing attitude. But even if he didn't preach willingly, he had a stewardship before the Lord and was accountable to him to fulfill his mission. I know I can identify to some degree with that in my own calling to the ministry, that really wasn't a choice. It's like, Don, you're either going to do this or you're going to end up with no reward in my presence, and you might have an abbreviated life, so what's your choice? You really don't have much of a choice at that point. Anyway, Paul then gloried in relative to his ministry of the gospel that when he preached it, he did so without financial charge to his hearers. And he demonstrated thereby that he was a messenger of integrity before the Lord, that he was not in the ministry with the false motive of the love of money. In another passage, Paul complained that false teachers loved money. And so what they did is they would fleece their hearers for everything they could get out of them so that they get more money. Sounds like some preachers today, right? I was talking to a believer here last Sunday, and he said, I know pastors, evangelical pastors, who are worth in the tens of millions of dollars. They're pastors of large churches. But he turned to me and he said, Pastor, what good is that? And I said, Yeah, what good is that? It's almost a liability. If you're worth tens of millions of dollars, let's say you're worth $30 or $40 million, what kind of a help is that to your testimony? You know, the world looks at that and says, the guy's in it for money. And it hurts your credibility. I think you're much better off just being very modest financially. At least you look more credible to the world. And you know, what are you going to do with it? In fact, this fellow shared with me, he says, Pastor, when you die, can't they can only bury you in one suit at a time and in only one casket. I said, that's it. You know, so if you're worth $30 million, you can't take it with you. That's the point. Everybody else is going to get it. So why hoard that money? But Paul was demonstrating integrity. He had the right to receive, but while he was out preaching, he was out working so that when he preached, nobody could accuse him of being somebody who was greedy for money or that he was a gold digger, he's living off of other people. Paul was out there earning his own keep so that when he preached it, he could make the gospel free, and that gave him integrity. That demonstrated his integrity to everybody, to unsaved people and so forth. So that's why he was doing this. And, you know, there's a general principle here. Whatever we can do to demonstrate genuine integrity in our lives is very, very important, because if we are demonstrating that we are people of integrity, our credibility goes up. If our credibility goes up, then people have a tendency to listen because they believe that you mean what you say. You're not in it for some devious means or motive. So Paul had laid aside his right to be free of all men, to enslave himself to all men through earning his own livelihood, that he might gain more converts because of the testimony of his integrity. That's why he said in verse 19, "For though I be free of all men, yet I have made myself a slave," literally, "to all, that I might gain the more." Now the Apostle Paul then applied this principle to the various groups he was trying to evangelize. In refusing to exercise his rights when it was applicable to them, Paul was becoming a Jew to the Jews under the law, that he might gain more of them because of his testimony of financial integrity. In refusing to exercise his rights when he was applicable to them, Paul was becoming to those outside of the law as one without law. He didn't mean that he was lawless before God, but subject to the spiritual law of Christ, that he might gain more of those who were outside the law through his testimony of financial integrity. In refusing to exercise his rights when it was applicable to them, Paul was becoming to the weak as a weak man, that he might gain more of the weak through his testimony of financial integrity. It's interesting, Paul was made all things to all men, that he might by all means save some, including his testimony of financial integrity, by not making his preaching of the gospel a financial charge to anyone. This reminds me of the missionary to China, Hudson Taylor. When Hudson Taylor went there, he was looked upon as a white devil. That's what the Chinese referred to him. So he decided, I'm going to become as much of a Chinese as I could. So he wore his hair braided like the Chinese, braided down the back like the Chinese men did. He wore Chinese clothes and so forth. And eventually, after many years, the Chinese accepted him. And when they accepted him, he could witness the gospel to them. And he was able to lead a number of them to Jesus Christ. And of course, he's the founder of the China Inland Mission. Led, and then because of his work and the work of some other missionaries, after the communists took over, the church continued to grow, and now there are at least 50 million, we believe, 50 million Christians in China, in Red China. That's as many Christians as there are professing evangelicals in the United States. So, he was a man of actually poor health. They didn't know if he would live when he went to China, but that's what he did. He tried his best to be identified with the Chinese, and he succeeded. Well, Paul added that he did all this for the sake of the gospel, that he preached that he might share in its blessings of winning many more to Christ through his self-imposed restrictions on his own rights. Now, this effort to restrict his use of his rights required a lot of self-discipline. And like an athlete in training to win a prize, Paul disciplined himself to restrict using his personal rights, like receiving financial remuneration for his ministry, and he urged others to follow his lead. You know, Paul worked at tent making. We know that it was very laborious work because in one situation there were people who were demon-possessed, people who were lepers and so forth who were going through the city dump where Paul had discarded his work aprons because they were actually soiled with too much perspiration, so he'd throw them away. And people were touching these things and being healed. But these work aprons, Paul was going through work apron after work apron because of his hard, hard labor. So this was labor where he was perspiring profusely as he worked, but he was doing this out of love for people so as to demonstrate that he was a man of financial integrity. And Paul noted that athletes worked hard in self-discipline to get in shape for their athletic competitions just to gain a corruptible crown, though we believers do so for an incorruptible crown. These corruptible crowns are really important. If you won in the Olympic Games, for example, the runner who won there was crowned with a wreath around his head. Now that wreath demonstrated something that was very important. His family, including his wife and his children, for the rest of their lives were taken care of by the state. It was like a welfare system. The man himself didn't have to work after that. He was taken care of by the state for the rest of his life. So this was a prize that was really worthwhile to you, to your family, and to your children for the rest of their lives as well. So it was very, very important. But we are striving for an incorruptible crown, which is even greater than that. So think of it. Maybe you didn't get a chance to run, and maybe you don't have the athletic prowess to win in the Olympics. Don't worry about it. You have an opportunity to win a crown that is greater than an Olympic prize. And that crown is the crown that you'll be rewarded by the Lord Jesus someday in eternity for doing his will. So with this realization, Paul explained that he did not figuratively as an athlete run aimlessly or box as one who beats the air, but he disciplined his body, keeping it under control, lest after preaching to others, himself should be disqualified and miss the prize of the incorruptible crown from the Lord. Okay. The lesson is to enhance his effectiveness in the gospel ministry that he had received of the Lord. Paul laid aside the exercise of a number of his rights, especially that of receiving financial remuneration from his hearers, that he might demonstrate real integrity in preaching with real concern for the souls of his hearers, not for financial gain, thus leading to more people trusting in the Lord, to the added eternal reward of the Lord. Paul strove hard in this effort involving self-discipline that he might not have his ministry cut short in divine discipline for moral laxity. So, may we strive before the Lord to use or refuse to use the rights we have, that we leave the best possible testimony we can before others to enhance our effectiveness in view of our future great accountability to God. I want to open up and give an illustration to you, and I think this will probably be an eye-opener to you and helpful to you. In the background in which I was raised in southern Nigeria. My father also is from the Midwest. And the combination of my rearing in southwestern Nigeria, northern Nigeria, and my father's culture from the West, I naturally use my eyes very differently than you. And no one has actually correctly understood the way I use my eyes. One of the things I do is drop my eyes when I'm in the presence of a woman under certain circumstances. That has been seen as very troublesome. Some people have thought that that meant that I was trying to seduce or flirt. It doesn't mean that at all. Some have thought that I drop my eyes because of fear, and I've been diagnosed as that. That's not it at all. In my background, and my father practiced this, my grandfather and so forth, if a man drops his eyes, he drops his eyes because he's expressing self-restraint in a polite gesture. Now, he may do it for a positive reason, he may do it for a negative reason. Positively, if you're meeting a woman that you haven't seen for some time and so forth, you drop your eyes in order to demonstrate that you are restraining your masculine dominance so that she has freedom to be herself. It's a form of politeness. I understand that that's the worst possible thing you can do in South Africa. You don't want to do that. That's seen as a form of flirtation or seduction. So I'm working very hard to change that. Another reason you may drop your eyes if you're restraining yourself, if a woman approaches you like a prostitute, that's such a horrifying experience that you'll drop your eyes to signal to her that she's done something very wrong. How does a woman approach me as a prostitute in my background? If she walks quickly, if she's loud, if she's aggressive in any way like that, and she surprises you, that's how a prostitute approaches you. Now, unfortunately, New England women operate somewhat to that degree, and same with women from South Africa. But if I can see the ladies coming and I'm not surprised, then I can respond properly. But if I'm surprised, they come around the corner quickly and so forth, then it'll shock me and I'll drop my eyes because I'm recoiling from what to me is the behavior of a prostitute. Well, I'm working very, very hard to change that because I've been practicing that for 64 years, all right? There's another thing you do. If there is a person, especially a woman or a person of the opposite gender that you have trouble understanding, you don't interact with them up close. You stand back and you watch them from a distance to see how they interact with others of the same gender, because that's when they let their guard down. That way you get to know them from a safe distance, and then when it's safe, you come up close. That is absolutely forbidden in New England because that's viewed as staring from a distance, or it might be viewed as voyeurism. So I'm working very hard to change that. If I want to continue to minister effectively at NEPOG, I have to stop what I've been practicing for 64 years. And that's what I'm attempting to do at this point. So this is a cultural thing. Part of it's a mixture of the Midwest and the United States. Part of it's from southern Nigeria and northern Nigeria. In fact, the southwestern Nigerians, it's the national pastime to stare at people from a distance. Everybody does it. And I grew up in amongst the Yoruba people where they practice that constantly. That's very forbidden here in New England. If you have been raised in New England, if you were to go to southwestern Nigeria, you wouldn't stand it. You'd be on a plane in 15 minutes to get out of there because the whole village, I used to have a whole village stop and watch me and stare at me as I was a child. And it made me feel nervous at first. My dad says, just relax, they've never seen a white boy before. So sometimes I would learn to put on a little act in front of the people and make them laugh, at least to break the tension. But so I have a very different background from you. And yet I'm the one, since I'm the stranger with that, I'm the one that has to change. And I'm willing to do that. But it's going to take time because this is very deeply ingrained. I'm not even conscious many times of what I do that is offensive. Also, and I preached, I was raised to preach giving people sustained eye contact. You don't do that in New England, okay? If there's eye contact, it has to be very brief, especially if it's a person of the opposite gender. That's difficult for me. I don't have that perfected. I may never perfect it, but I'm learning to do that. That's all different. But I just want to help you to understand. But this is what the Lord tells us to do. We have to refuse to use our rights. And I have a right to act the way I've acted for 64 years. My parents never corrected. My mother's a native of New England. But because of the offense that these actions produce, I have to restrict them for the good of the edifying of the people of God. And so I plan on doing that. But there may be some other area. Maybe we can learn that what we do, we might have the right to do certain things around certain people in the area, but if it's offensive to them and it really restricts our effort to reach them, we need to learn to restrain that so that we can minister to them effectively.